Welcome to your Tuesday edition of What Matters in North Carolina. Glad to have you listening to the program. My name is Mark Shiver. We have, as always, a really exciting program for you today. As you may have figured out over the last couple of days, we've been talking about how important free markets and capitalism together are to our economy. We heard a lot about socialism when Bernie Sanders was running for president. We heard a lot about class envy. We heard about equality and inequality and how the rich are really the cause of all the problems in this country. But you know, I wanted to remind you about something. I was thinking about this the other day as we were getting ready to go to church. And just out of nowhere, I've been thinking about this whole free market thing. And out of nowhere, I was reminded that there is a verse in the Bible where Jesus himself said, "The poor you will always have with you." And he was saying that the reality of life is that some people are just going to do better financially, economically, than others. I don't think that you can look at any of the things that we find in the Gospels where there was an advocation for income equality. And certainly there was an advocation to take care of those who are in need. And in future programs, we're actually going to talk about how if people of faith and churches really got more involved here in North Carolina in helping people, it could have the phenomenal effect of greatly reducing the need for government assistance in people's lives. But the fact of the matter is that life is not intended to be equal. There are plenty of people who are smarter than me, for example, and they're making a lot more money than I am. There are people that have different personality traits. They're willing to take greater risk, and some of them may lose greatly, but others may win greatly. People, as a matter of reality, often are born into different situations, and certainly this is something to be aware of when it comes to those who are born into poverty and born into situations that they have no control over and where it looks like opportunity really doesn't come their way at all. And we're going to talk tomorrow with Dr. Salim Firth of the Heritage Foundation about part of the free market economy is getting government out of the way. And in North Carolina, one of the big barriers to people getting into business and getting into opportunities that may help lift them out of a place of poverty is occupational licensing. And looking forward a lot to that conversation, because in North Carolina, it really is, I've coined the word silly for the way some of these things are set up. Just to give you a little taste, if you want to be an auctioneer in North Carolina, then you have to have a license. And so anyway, before we get off onto that topic, which we'll definitely be talking with Dr. Firth about tomorrow, we're talking today to a couple of people who are really expert in this area of free markets and capitalism. Dr. Peter Navarro, he is a Harvard-trained economist. He's been advising Republican candidate Donald Trump. We'll be talking with him about the differences in ideology between what we've seen from Hillary Clinton, which is a more government-reliant economy, and the Trump campaign, which focuses more on free markets. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about how trade has impacted North Carolina, some of these trade agreements like NAFTA, China's entry into the World Trade Organization, and now the upcoming Trans-Pacific Partnership, which could really, really have an adverse effect on not only the United States economy, but our country as a whole, along with its sovereignty. And so these are things, folks, that people do not roll around in their daily life thinking about. I would imagine that had you not been listening and had you not heard me say Trans-Pacific Partnership just now, those words formed together would not have entered into your mind today or tomorrow or in the near future at all. But there are things going on all around us that you need to be aware of, and that's why I'm here. That's why we are here. What Matters in North Carolina? Things that are important to you that you may not be aware of, or you may have heard of, but you don't really understand completely. And so that's the service that we are bringing to you at What Matters in North Carolina. We're also going to talk with Dr. Adam Hyde, and he is from the BB&T Center for the Study of Capitalism. And again, our conversation with him, delving into free markets and why the whole concept of liberty is closely tied with free markets and property rights. And this whole thing to me is fascinating. And I know that it's not what you would call a hot topic, a hot take, you know, a sexy topic, but these are bedrock pillars of conservative ideology, and you and I need to understand and to be able to talk and articulate some of these concepts to people when you hear things like, well, you know, the government needs to do this and that and this and that. And you can very calmly reply, well, no, that's not what we need. And so I hope that you are benefiting. I know I'm learning as we go along, and that you'll share with your friends and your family some of the conversations that we're having on these topics about free markets and capitalism and occupational licensing. I noticed on Facebook, a friend of mine shared the conversation that we had yesterday with Brian Balfour about free markets. And so the word is getting out, and we appreciate that. But be sure to tell your friends and family, listen, go to freedomactionnetwork.com and listen to What Matters in North Carolina. You can also listen to the NC Gun Dad show, become more familiar with your Second Amendment rights, and also Free to Brew, talking about the craft brewing industry, how it has exploded, and how, once again, the good old government wants to get in the way. And so there's a lot going on at freedomactionnetwork.com, but please listen, download, tell your friends, tell your family that What Matters in North Carolina is here, and we're having really important conversations. I was thrilled that Eric Trump stopped by yesterday. If you missed that, feel free to listen to yesterday's program as we sat down and talked with Eric Trump, a really nice guy, very articulate, well-spoken, and just a regular guy. If you didn't know who he was, got a chance to walk across the parking lot with him, and yeah, may have been a buddy that I was fixing to walk into a restaurant and watch a game. Really, really nice guy. So thanks for listening to What Matters in North Carolina. Remember, you can find us on Twitter at What Matters NC, at What Matters NC, and you can also find us on Facebook, What Matters in North Carolina. You can also download the show anytime you'd like at the iTunes and Google Play Store. So again, spread the word. What Matters in North Carolina is here. We're here to help, and we're here to help you learn and to be able to understand and share the important things that matter to you and your family here in North Carolina. Joining us now on What Matters in North Carolina, helping us continue our look at free markets and how they work and how we can better understand the positives and the great effect that they can have on everyone in economy, not just those that may be more well-to-do, is Dr. Adam Hyde, and he is with Wake Forest University. He is a healthcare economist with specializations in industrial organization, public policy, and labor economics. Dr. Hyde, welcome to What Matters in North Carolina.
Hello.
Well, I appreciate your time this morning, and we've been looking at the topic of free markets and capitalism and how they work. And from your perspective, could you sort of give us just a rough definition when you think of capitalism and free markets? What does that bring to your mind?
So, you know, the term capitalism in and of itself isn't my favorite term. I think it's a charged word, especially in today's world.
Yeah.
But if we look back to sort of the founding of the discipline of economics, you know, Adam Smith didn't use that word. He just simply referred to the system that we call free market capitalism as the obvious and simple system of natural liberty. And I think when you phrase it that way, it sort of brings to mind things that we all associate with free markets today, but the idea of capitalism itself as an ism, even, it can bring up negative feelings about exploitation of workers or things that I don't think Smith necessarily had in mind. Uh, And so in today's world, I shy away from that word, but I think in general, it reflects a leaning toward decentralized decision making. And I think that's probably the biggest characteristic of a system, to use Smith's word, of natural liberty.
Well, that is fascinating, and I can certainly understand, because when you say that capitalism has sort of a charged word, conservatives in particular, Dr. Hyde, have sort of gotten a bad rap by embracing free markets and that sort of thing, because it comes off occasionally as being less than thoughtful to those who, you know, may not have as much or may not be doing as well economically at a certain point in time. But really, the alternative, which is to have something that is much more government-centric, really is, and ultimately is probably not going to help people as much either.
Yeah, I mean, once again, you know, I sort of hearken back to Smith and the founding of the discipline and the first sort of organized thought about economics. And if you go back and read, certainly with Smith's first book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, I mean, there is a concern for the poor in that book, but also in The Wealth of Nations, an inquiry into the nature and causes of the wealth of nations. You know, so that's really, you know, if you read the full title and think about what that means, you know, it's a movement away from a world where all of us are poor into understanding how we may even come out of this desperate poverty that was seen in before the Industrial Revolution, but really throughout human history. So if we go back to Smith's words and think about what the world in which he was writing these, you know, we can look at the idea that when we have the freedom to actually make our own decisions about our own economic transactions, that's very empowering for a class of people that had not had power historically. And so the fact that they have the ability to respect the person across the bargaining counter, you know, if we were at a shop trying to make a purchase, you know, we all have the ability to view this transaction on its merits and walk away if we don't like the deal, or accept the deal and part with our money and get in exchange something that we value more. And if that's the case, then it must be true that all of us are made better off when that happens. If we've mutually agreed upon a transaction, then that says that, yes, I'm getting something out of it, but if you agreed to it, that means you're getting something out of it as well. And so both of us have found a way to get better together in that story when we are allowed to exercise our freedom of choice and decide whether we want to purchase something or not. So now, if you expand that and take it out to society at large, I think that there is a lot in there to think about how consumers make those decisions. But then if you expand that to the system at large, you can understand this empowering behavior and what that means for self-respect and what that means for the dignity of the other person with whom you may be transacting, who may not know everything about you, and they don't need to. We can just say, at this moment, right now, today, can we be made better off together? Now, expanding that out, you know, we all don't have knowledge of each other's circumstances, but we have decentralized the decision process so that you and I can come to an agreement about whether this exchange makes us both better. So once you remove my own ability to make that decision, or remove it, you know, to a distant geographical location or a distant social class, whether it be a bureaucratic class or an aristocracy or a ruling class, we think throughout history, those people can't possibly have the same knowledge about what's going to make me better off. If I am making these decisions for myself, it's clearly the case that I know more about my own circumstances than you do. Now, if that's true, then regardless of what the transaction is that we're talking about, it must be the case that I have knowledge that you don't about my own circumstances, and I should be able to utilize that knowledge to make the most out of what resources I have, even if they're limited. And so, but to really get to your question about how economic freedoms empower the poor even more than that, I think we should focus just on the division of labor that Adam Smith put forth in the book The Wealth of Nations as an empirically observed phenomenon of how people got better together and how people made things in a more productive capacity. They produced things that were cheaper. They found efficient ways of production, efficient modes of production that led to a decreased cost for anything that was made, bought or sold, produced, manufactured, even in agriculture, it doesn't matter. Whatever the production process is, the fact that people were allowed to experiment, make their own decisions about how to employ their financial resources, how to employ their time and energy, they will find ways to improve their own conditions. I mean, I think at heart, we are all equivalent moral agents, and we should respect our own moral agency. And one of the ways that we can do that is allow people to reap and sow seeds that will be productive in the future that other people may not think are productive. Sometimes I'm going to get it wrong, and I'm going to sow some seeds that do not bear fruit. But that's okay. I should be able to make that mistake, learn from that mistake, and experiment. Maybe next time I can use a different fertilizer and my harvest will be plentiful. But that should be my decision to make. And then in doing so, it only takes one innovation to lower the cost for everybody if it's replicable. And so in some sense, it's an experimentation and research and how to produce things more efficiently. And then that translates down into what Smith called universal opulence, which really does, in many ways, benefits the poor more than it benefits anyone else. And what I mean by that is if you allow the division of labor to truly go out to its natural conclusion, we will find ways to produce things more cheaply. And then if you take on faith the empirical notion that the poorest among us spend a much larger percentage of their incomes on consumption goods, especially in the United States, that is true. So if that's true, then the prices of those consumption goods are falling by allowing economic freedoms to exist. The division of labor increases productivity so much that it can decrease the cost of producing things for the most impoverished among us. So if they're spending most of their money on consumption goods, and now those consumption goods are cheaper, their standard of living has increased much more so than the wealthiest among us, who are not particularly income constrained, and so they don't feel the positive effect of those decreased prices in quite the same way that those of us who spend such large percentages of our income would.
Well, that's very fascinating, and you were talking, I was kind of visualizing in my mind, and our guest, by the way, Dr. Adam Hyde from Wake Forest University, the BB&T Center for the Study of Capitalism, and we're talking about free markets and how to lift up the poor through the notion of free markets. And it seems like what we have, as you were talking, I was kind of thinking to myself that we're not really seeing that, I guess, because we don't really have that in its purest form. But there's a whole segment of thought on the other side of the coin that would have people dependent on the government, which, from what you're describing, that doesn't lead to opportunity or hope in any way, to find oneself dependent on government for provision and assignment of work and that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think if you just even take back to the statements that I was just making about the idea of experimentation and utilizing your own resources to make your condition better, I think when we're dependent on the government, especially if you think about in-kind transfers, something like vouchers for a particular good, and so it's not really a market transaction at all that's happening, if that's the case, then there's no incentive to really experiment on your end. There's no financial capital that you have that you might go out and try to actually better your condition with. It's just today, am I going to use this particular voucher to get this particular good that somebody has deemed necessary for my own existence? And that's a pretty hopeless lot. Is here's a ticket, go take it and get some food.
Well, Dr. Hyde, when it comes to applying what you're describing in real life, one of the things that we've also talked about is that maybe not a dependence, as it were, on government, but the obstruction that government can put in the way of people, even at the lower end of the economic scale, things like occupational licenses and fees and training requirements, which really seem to be in place more to protect the status quo than anything else. In North Carolina, we have hundreds of these things. And so even that involvement by the government in that segment of the economy and trying to, you know, charge people money to enter into a new field of endeavor, that can choke off opportunity and entrepreneurialism as well. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. North Carolina, but, you know, the rest of the country as well. I mean, professional licensure is sort of a hot topic, and it really is. Even if you take on faith that at one point, maybe there may have been some professions where that may have been a good idea, which, you know, may or may not be true, but let's just take that on faith for a moment. So what would the goal be? Maybe it would be safety, maybe it would be product quality or something like that. It's hard to believe that in today's world, with all of the decentralized feedback mechanisms that we have in terms of rating and evaluating producers of various goods, you think of Yelp, you go online and you can figure out whether you want to go to a particular restaurant or not, not because there is some certification that says, this is, you know, some distant government agency says, this is where foodies should go, or you know, tells you some signal of the product quality, or, you know, maybe some kind of signal of safety. If you have other consumers out there willing to spend a buck and willing to report back to the rest of the world what their experience was like, isn't that more informative than some designation by a third party ever could be?
Oh, absolutely.
Look at the actual experience of the customers. What are they telling you? You know, we have at our disposal now as a society information aggregation tools to help us with exactly that problem. So why should we put up hurdles for people to jump over in order to start a business just because we think they're not going to do a good job or we think there's some kind of training they need? Well, maybe that's true, but shouldn't we let the customers decide whether this producer has been adequately trained or not to provide the good? I mean, you know, we're able to judge for ourselves, and, you know, even individually we can make that decision clearly, but when taken to the society at large, that's what the internet is for in many ways, dissemination of information.
That's fascinating. Our guest, Dr. Adam Hyde, talking about free markets and all of this. Let me play devil's advocate momentarily. I mean, I agree completely with what you're saying, but I can't help but think that all of this somewhat seems a bit utopian, because what we have in our society clearly is not a pure form of what you were saying Adam Smith advocated and envisioned. But we do have people, like, for example, one of our guests recently was talking about price gouging laws and how that they actually are not beneficial in the long run, because they contribute to shortages, the theory being that people go out and buy more than they need if the price is not allowed to fluctuate to, you know, in a normal way. But there's I can't help but think, and again, I'm playing devil's advocate here, but in the back of my mind, that doesn't government play some role in the fact that people can definitely have a tendency to be greedy and to not, you know, want to help their fellow man? I remember when Hurricane Fran plowed through, or Hugo plowed through Charleston, my parents will tell me, you know, people were trying to sell ice for hundreds of dollars a bag, taking advantage of people who didn't have any electricity or water. And does government play any role there to try to mitigate, you know, natural human greed? Or would you agree that price gouging laws are not ultimately beneficial?
So it's interesting. Yeah, so the example of ice after a hurricane is a good one, right? If it were the case that, the government comes in and says, okay, we want to cap the price on ice to prevent people from unjustly extracting financial resources from those people who need help.
Right.
So that's the basic argument, is that these people are just in it to make a buck. They don't actually want to help these people who don't have ice. I would say, yes, those people are in it just to make a buck, but in so doing, are providing a service that is tremendously valuable to the people on the ground who don't have ice. Now, the argument is, okay, well, what about the people who don't have enough money to afford this now really high price? Maybe it's $100 a bag, but probably wouldn't get that high. But let's just say it did, $100 a bag for ice. So if it's the case that I'm really poor and I can't afford that ice, I'm going to be a little bit angry.
Right. Right?
But that's not the end of the story, right? The story keeps going and says, okay, well, the first guy or gal to bring and truck the ice into this affected area, they might get $100 a bag because there's literally not a cube of ice within 50 miles or something like that. So if you have to make some assumptions, but let's assume that people have lined up in order or in accordance with their preferences or something like that, and that the $100 a bag is going to go to the people who have the highest valued use for that ice. Maybe it's to keep medication cold or something like that. That's an extremely high value use. It's not to keep juice boxes and bottled waters or beer cans cold or something like that. So, but if you let some entrepreneurial soul truck in $100 a bag worth of ice, that's a signal to everyone else that the consumers in this area really need some ice.
Right.
And so when that happens, when that signal is sent that anyone is willing to pay $100, now it makes me, you know, as the poor person, really unhappy, but I'm about to be really happy because this $100 bag is now signaling to everybody who has ice within, you know, 200 miles, bring it all here and you might get $100 a bag for it. Maybe it sells for $1.50, $2, I don't know, maybe in Charlotte or something, but then you truck it to Winston-Salem, people are willing to pay a much higher price because we don't have it. Well, when enough people start making that decision, nobody can actually charge $100 a bag anymore, and the price starts to come down. And when it comes down, now all of a sudden, the poorest among us can afford ice, and we get it when we weren't getting it before. Okay, so now all of that is still sort of an idealized version.
Right.
Right. But it's dependent on the supply responding to that signal of the high price.
Well, that's really fascinating. I find this stuff just really amazing to think about because from a conservative standpoint, from those that really embrace the notion of a free market economy and the least government intervention possible, you know, it's often met, as I said at the beginning of our conversation, with the notion that the conservatives are just totally, you know, not mindful of those who are struggling in life and may not be as well off. And so I think that you've done a very good job in explaining how the system should work and can work. And we definitely don't want to look at more government intrusion, more government involvement, because that really offers no hope or opportunity.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, to go back to your comment about, you know, the story I just told may seem a little bit utopian, but what does a price gouging law prevent? It prevents exactly what we just described. And so then the question is, well, what's the next best alternative? What is the world in which we are left without the ability of the price mechanism to send the signal to bring more ice that I just described? And if price gouging is illegal, that signal's not sent, there's no ice.
Yeah.
So I mean, how is that better? If the government wants to make a rule that says we can't charge a higher price for ice than what the prevailing market price is today, or, you know, however complicated they want to make this mechanism, then shouldn't they be the ones bringing ice when we don't have it? If they have brought ice when we don't have it and are providing enough disaster relief, the story that I just told about anyone being willing to pay $100 for a bag of ice falls apart. Nobody would pay for ice. If the government wants to limit the price going up, then they should bear the responsibility of providing ice for the citizens. And if they don't, then we're really left in the cold.
Yeah.
I guess that's a bad phrase, right? Bad turn of phrase. We're left in the heat.
Exactly. Well, Dr. Adam Hyde, hope that in the very near future we'll be able to come together again, because your insight is excellent, and not only that, though, but your ability to articulate it is really, really good, and I know that our listeners will come away from our time together much better informed and with a much better understanding of some of these concepts. So thank you very much for being our guest on What Matters in North Carolina.
My pleasure.
All right. It's our pleasure to welcome to What Matters in North Carolina, Peter Navarro. He is a professor of economics and public policy at the Paul Mirage School of Business at the University of California, Irvine, and holds a PhD in economics from Harvard University, and also an author of more than 9 books. And Dr. Navarro, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be with you.
And we appreciate you making time for us today. With your vast economics background, it's got to be somewhat intriguing for you to be looking out at the political landscape and seeing basically two contrasts. One is a free market capitalism kind of based philosophy, and the other is a more government-dependent, government-centric based philosophy. I would say that through your years of economics, you're certainly able to comment on what do you think at this stage in the American economy and how things are going, which do you think would be more appropriate for our country?
Sure. Let me start off with, I think, one of the most important statistics in the Trump versus Clinton campaign, and that is from 1947 to 2001, the U.S. economy grew at a rate of 3.5% inflation adjusted. And then something happened along the way from 2002 to today. That growth rate has fallen to 1.9%.
Wow.
Wow is right. Because 1 percentage rate, 1 point, if you lose 1 point of GDP a year, that's 1.2 million jobs you fail to create. So if you think about it, if you go from 2002 to today, with that slower growth, it gets up around 20 million jobs that we failed to create. And that's about what we would need to get people, everybody back to work at a decent wage. Okay, so that's the problem. The mystery here is what happened and how do we get back to where we're going? Because clearly we have the ability to hit 3.5%. So the most pivotal event that happened in 2002 was China's entry into the World Trade Organization, which basically gave China access to our markets. They promised to play by the rules, but they didn't. So we had the beginning of a process of dumping products into our markets, often below cost, and that began like the steady erosion of our manufacturing base. North Carolina, in fact, prior to that, had already felt this hot devil's breath of bad trade deals going back to NAFTA, which, and you know, unfortunately, North Carolina was at the forefront of trade zone disasters because textiles and furniture in particular in North Carolina virtually got wiped out. But when China came in to the World Trade Organization after 2002, you had other industries affected. One of the big companies, one of the best companies in the world in North Carolina is Nucor, which is based out of Charlotte.
Right.
Makes steel. We've got China now dumping 100 million tons of steel into global markets below cost. I mean, Nucor and Dan D'Amico there, its former CEO, has been fighting that battle for years. So the question is, what's going to happen? What can you do about it? And if you compare the competing plans of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, it's just as you described it. It's free market versus government. On the one hand, you have Hillary Clinton, who has promised to raise taxes. She's made no bones about that. She's also promised to continue increasing regulations in the regulatory environment. She's made no bones about that. And that's important because annually there's a $2 trillion regulatory burden on both us as individuals and us as businesses, which drag growth down. So higher taxes suppress growth, more regulation suppresses growth. And then on the energy issue, the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton have effectively declared war on both the coal industry and the oil and natural gas industry in this country. And what that's going to mean as a practical matter, is higher electricity prices, because a lot of our plants are coal-fired, as well as higher energy and gasoline prices. So again, that's growth inhibiting. That won't get us to the 3%, 3.5% we need to be. And then finally, and I think most importantly of all for the people in North Carolina to understand, is that it's the trade problem. We run an $800 billion trade deficit in goods with the world. For China, it's $1 billion every day of the year, and add one for leap year, because our deficit with them is $366 billion. So those are big numbers, but all people need to understand is that when you run those big trade deficits, it's lower growth, right? So if you look at all four points of her policy compass, taxes, trade, regulation, and energy, it points to slower growth, which is not going to get us out of the morass we're in. And it's not just, my friend, it's not just that we're not going to create the millions of jobs that we need or the increase in our income that we need. We also won't have a tax base sufficient to cover at the local level, roads, bridges, schools, things like that, and at the national level, things like Medicare, Social Security, and national defense. Okay, so if you contrast that with Donald Trump, it's literally day and night. Trump will cut taxes. Trump will reduce regulation. Trump will unleash our energy sector. Trump will eliminate the trade deficit. And all of those things work interactively and together. For example, one of the problems we have in this country is that if a company is trying to make a decision whether to build new plant equipment in a place like Raleigh or Mexico, that company is going to be influenced by the fact that we have the highest corporate tax in any major nation in the world. So that company can go to Mexico or China and get an immediate tax break. That's how we push our companies offshore. Donald Trump will slash the corporate tax and deal with that. And if we do that, if we get more investment in plant equipment, manufacturing facilities in North Carolina, what that does is allow us to make more products on domestic soil, buy less products from foreigners, and that also helps our trade deficit. And all of that works synergistically. And so if that company is deciding in Raleigh where to invest, it also is going to help if the energy costs are lower and if the regulatory burden's lower. So this is a once-in-a-lifetime election. It's an election about change, but it's change about the most important issue, I think, facing this country. And, you know, on top of that, you've got also the immigration issue. It's like immigration seems like it's not an economic issue, but, for example, the African-American communities throughout our inner cities have been the biggest victims of illegal immigration, because disproportionately it's been illegal immigrants taking those lower-end jobs that the African-American community would love to have. And so it's a choice, and it's a big choice.
Our guest is Dr. Peter Navarro, joining us on What Matters in North Carolina, talking about all things economics and how to view some of the economic issues that are a large part of this year's presidential election. Now, some people don't find trade deficits to be all that alarming, Dr. Navarro. What would you say to that? Because I think that, there are a lot of factors that go into that. But from what it sounds like, you feel like this is not a good thing that our deficit, particularly with China, is so large.
It's hard to argue that trade deficits are good for this country. If you look at the simple math of how any nation grows, it's only four things. It's consumption and it's government spending, which have been fairly stable over the years. But the other two parts are where the problem lies. It's investment, and it's also what we call net exports. So when you run a trade deficit, when you import more than you export, you're literally directly subtracting from GDP growth. So just by simple arithmetic, trade deficits matter. And then the other part is this whole idea, if you're spending a dollar in Mexico rather than in Raleigh on new manufacturing, that also pulls it down. But you can just look at it from an intuitive level as well. If instead we had more textile, furniture and steel manufacturing here in the United States, and we were selling to the world and selling into our own markets, those manufacturing jobs have a very high multiplier. So they create manufacturing jobs elsewhere in the economy. So just from an intuitive level, you know, if you lose a job, you know, if a steel worker loses their job because of unfair trade with China, right, that steel worker basically helps support jobs elsewhere in the economy, whether it's the movie theater and the restaurant, or it's some of the suppliers to that steel factory. So trade deficits do matter. They matter a great deal. And if you look at the slow growth we've had since 2002, the big difference has been the bad trade deals that Hillary Clinton has got us into. And it's interesting to me that the three worst trade deals in American history, NAFTA, China, and the World Trade Organization, and the 2012 South Korean deal, they all have Clinton footprints and handprints on. I mean, it's truly remarkable that somebody running for president is even able to do that, given that history. It was interesting. The big reason why Hillary Clinton lost to Barack Obama in 2008, I don't know if you know this, but Obama wiped her out in the Midwest by attacking her on NAFTA and her role in destroying jobs in the Midwest. Maybe he did that while touring North Carolina as well, I don't know. But I do know in Ohio and Pennsylvania that was a profound message. And people, I think it's important that voters understand her culpability in this economic malaise and morass that we're in.
Our guest, Dr. Peter Navarro, speaking of China, one of the things that I personally have been concerned about, and I've been preparing for our conversation, looking at some of the stuff that you have written and your book, Crouching Tiger, I believe it was called, is a massive bestseller, and well-deservedly so. But it bothers me, Dr. Navarro, that China owns so much of our debt. And correct me if I'm wrong, and I don't want to sound totally stupid here, but I've always thought that if China were to begin to massively sell off the debt that they own, that could hurt the United States pretty significantly. Am I on the right track there? Because $3 trillion owned by China.
You're absolutely on the right track. If you think about it, we talked earlier about how the trade deficit with China is $366 billion, right?
Right.
So you can see how in the space of just 3 years, you can run up $1 trillion of debt, right? And then you do that over the 15-year period and it quickly gets into problems. As far as them selling off our debt, they've actually threatened to do that repeatedly any time that the U.S. government has tried to crack down on their cheating. They use it now as a weapon, and the more indebted we get to China, the more they try to control us as a country, which is fairly amazing. I mean, we're the biggest economy in the world, we're the biggest democracy in the world, and now we have a Chinese Communist Party government basically trying to tell us what to do. I mean, I don't think the American people appreciate that. But you know what scares me a lot more than China buying up our treasury bills and threatening to dump them on world markets is they're buying up our farmland.
Yeah.
They're buying up our real estate. They're buying up our companies and then stripping those companies of technology and trade secrets and shipping that back to China. And this is a battle It's an undeclared trade war that's been going on for 15 years with China. And some states have suffered more than others. I would say that North Carolina has been at the front lines of that. And Donald Trump is the one who's going to bring peace to that undeclared trade war by cracking down on the cheating and cutting better deals with these trading partners that take advantage of it. It's China's the biggest cheater, but they're not the only one. We've got issues with Mexico and NAFTA. We've got issues with some of the other countries we run large deficits with.
Dr. Navarro, I've been reading up on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has gotten some run in this presidential campaign, but it really seems like it's not something that would be very beneficial to the United States. Your thoughts on that? Is it another NAFTA? Is it another China coming into the World Trade Organization that just is not going to serve the United States well?
Well, it's a three-letter acronym that should be a four-letter word. the crown jewel of bad trade deals. It's the capstone to NAFTA, China, and the World Trade Organization and the South Korean deal. It would effectively wipe out much of the rest of our manufacturing base. It's a deal that Hillary Clinton called the gold standard. She's been trying to back away from it, but even as she says, read my lips, no TPP, her husband is saying he likes TPP. Her lieutenant when she was Secretary of State, Kurt Campbell, was recently in Australia saying that Hillary Clinton would vote for TPP. Her closest confidant, Terry McAuliffe in Virginia, the governor there, said Hillary would vote for TPP. And, it's a 5,000-page document that surrenders both our sovereignty and our markets. It's just a really bad deal. And Trump, that's not one Trump's going to renegotiate. He's going to rip that thing up. Because the style, what we need to do as the largest economy and market in the world is negotiate with countries bilaterally rather than multilaterally. As soon as you go into something like the TPP, you basically, in a one-nation, one-vote system, surrender your sovereignty. We would have as much control over the process as the Sultan of Brunei. One nation, one vote. It's absurd. And this is a key critical issue in this campaign. Hillary's for it. Trump's against it. Therein lies the tale.
Well, what is driving, under a time schedule, so we'll wind this up, and I appreciate your time today, but Dr. Navarro, what is driving this notion that we've seen in the Obama administration that, let's surrender so much of the United States sovereignty, for example, in this global warming climate agreement that was negotiated in Paris, and now this Trans-Pacific Partnership? Seems like, the goal here is just to give up more and more of America's sovereignty, and I don't think people really understand that.
You're absolutely right. I think that with Obama, when he came into office, I think partly that was idealism. But over the last 8 years, he's fallen prey to the same kind of political corruption as Hillary Clinton. Because the reality of the political game is that if you want to get elected to higher office in Washington, you have to take money from the large multinational corporations who've been shipping our jobs offshore and from Wall Street that make money from those transactions. And so you change your tune. You lose your perspective and you sell the American people out. The beauty of Donald Trump is he's outside that process, not a career politician, and he's a self-funded candidate. This is globalization. I mean, it's like termites in the house. It's been steadily eating away at the fabric of American life, both economically and geostrategically. And that's got to change.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Peter Navarro, thank you very much for being our guest here on What Matters in North Carolina. You have raised some topics that really need folks here in North Carolina particularly need to think about, because we have, as you said, been hit very hard in the manufacturing sector, textiles and furniture, as you indicated. So thank you for bringing those things once again to our attention, and we appreciate it very much, sir.
No, I appreciate your time. Great questions. Maybe we'll talk again. Take care.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Peter Navarro here on What Matters in North Carolina. By the way, you can go to peternavarro.com. His latest book, Crouching Tiger, What China's Militarism Means for the World, one of the top 10 books of the year. Just really fascinating and eye-opening. You know, folks, China is huge. We all know that. And there's several, more than a few people living there. And so they have an enormous military. They have an enormous population. They also have enormous problems economically and all of that because of the communist influence. They're trying to blend communism with some form of democracy. But the biggest deal here is the fact that they do own a lot of United States paper, treasury bonds, treasury notes. And folks, it's been thought about for probably over a decade now, and they've threatened, as Dr. Navarro said, to begin to just flood the market with our paper. That would have enormous negative consequences. Now, they've not done it, but, you know, when you think about this stuff, does it bother you? Because it really gives me pause for concern. It's like, year after year after year, our country just continues to roll along, and everything seems to be okay. But under the current presidential administration, our national debt has grown, what is it now, like $19, $20 trillion? It can't be that much. It's incredible. China owns $3 trillion of United States debt. They are building, buying up land and properties all over the United States. And one thing you have to remember about the Chinese is that they are very, very patient and typically not given to a lot of pomp, a lot of circumstance, a lot of drawing attention to what they are doing. But remember that the goal of communism is to spread. It's like Islam. It's not content to remain within its four walls. And so very quietly, without any fanfare, China has been buying up, propping up the U.S. economy, really. If they stopped buying our treasury offerings, we would be really in a bad way. And what I fear is that at some point, the United States is going to have to, you know, have a big flush, to not get gross on you here, but the system is going to have to endure some very challenging times. You know, as an individual, a family, a business owner, you can't just keep borrowing and borrowing and borrowing and borrowing. Now, obviously, the United States government has the capacity to just print money. But the more that happens, the less value there is. And so at what point is the piper going to come calling, demanding to be paid? And what will the American economy look like when it has to come to grips with owing so much money to China and to others? What is it going to look like? What is that going to do to the futures of our kids and our kids' kids? Because I firmly believe that you cannot continue to prop things up. At some point, the foundation is going to slip or weaken. And when you have a nation that owns $3 trillion of our debt, what if they flooded the market and said, all right, we're selling half of this today? Well, that would not be good. And they have, again, as Dr. Navarro said, they've threatened. They haven't done it. But you hear Donald Trump, you know, let's reduce our trade deficit with China, and talking with a lot of bravado. And again, here on this program, we are not endorsing any candidates, any political parties. But you have to wonder, is it really going to be that simple to deal with them? Because they are in a position of having a lot of leverage right now. I don't know that Hillary Clinton has any plan on how to work with the Chinese. And so issues like these are very, very, very important. Again, this monstrosity known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership could actually negatively affect the sovereignty of the United States. You and I haven't read that treaty, that agreement, whatever you call it. We haven't gone through it with a fine-tooth comb, but we have had guests on What Matters in North Carolina that have said, this is not good for our country. Now, we know that candidate Trump opposes it. Candidate Clinton is down as supporting it. But I'm telling you, folks, we need leadership in our country. We need real solutions, and we need folks in Congress with some semblance of a spine and a backbone. I wrote a couple of days ago that the vote on the continuing resolution shows which party is in the majority. Yeah, on paper, numerically, the Republicans have the majority in both the House and the Senate in Congress. And yet you look at this continuing resolution, a perfect opportunity for conservative leadership to stand up and say, no, we're not going to fund Planned Parenthood. No, we're not going to fund President Obama's transgender dictates. We're not going to fund his DACA dictates, the immigration for children thing, his executive order there. This was a prime opportunity. And what happened? Big whiff. Nothing. Zip. Zero. Nada. Republicans voted en masse for this continuing resolution. And what that is, if you don't know, is it's a way to keep the government funded for a few months. They're going to come back after the elections in December and do it all over again. Do you not believe with all of your heart that there's going to be ridiculous spending in there? Because guys who are either retiring or who got defeated, they're going to vote. They don't care. And so we have a bunch of, you know, spending drunk representatives in our House and Senate. And even the Republicans are just weak. They're not doing anything. There's a handful, the old reliable Walter Jones and I believe Congressman Meadows and Walker. George Holding voted against it. But what in the world? Senator Byrd, Senator Tillis, and all these other Republicans in our state, just going right along with the Democrats. Not one single stand was made against spending or against President Obama's initiatives and executive orders. Every single one was funded. This is what's going on in our country. So it used to be that if you were a conservative, you could look at the Democratic Party and say, well, you know, their platform and their ideology is certainly different from mine. But when the Republicans vote en masse across this country to put people in office believing that they're going to try to rein in spending, believing they're going to try and lower this surging deficit, and all of a sudden they pull something like this, it really is frustrating. And folks, I don't have enough hair left to continue to pull out, so I don't know what I'm going to do. But anyway, thank you so much for listening to What Matters in North Carolina. We appreciate it. We appreciate you telling your friends and your family. You can find us in the iTunes and Google Play stores. You can find us on Twitter at What Matters in C, on Facebook, What Matters in North Carolina. We will be back tomorrow with another amazing show, so don't miss it. Thanks so much for listening to What Matters in North Carolina.